ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves. We stood tall and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
The really good news this week is we're coming out of an economic slump. Australia's official rate of economic growth has climbed above 2% to 2.1, getting a 2 in front of it for the first time in 2 years. That rate of economic growth is well above Australia's population growth, meaning that on the face of it, our standard of living, GDP per person, is growing and growing at twice the rate it was. If it doesn't feel like that to you, it could be because you're not where the average is, or it could be because the figures themselves are weird. GDP is weird. It's actually a very strange concept. We're about to find out how strange it really is. Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and my guest this week, economic modeller, GDP expert, and director of the Centre of Policy Studies at Victoria University, Janine Dixon, who in an earlier life used to help put the GDP and the figures associated with them together at the Australian Bureau of Statistics. And someone else who used to help put them together, urban economist Terry Rawnsley, who these days is Director of Planning and Infrastructure Economics at KPMG Australia. Welcome, Terry, and welcome back, Janine.
Hello, Peter.
Hi, Peter.
Janine, GDP is weird. Before it was standardised, when the concept was being developed before the Second World War, it wasn't going to include military spending. That was regarded as destruction rather than consumption. It wasn't going to include some government spending, spending that wasn't useful. It's been standardised now, but can you tell us a bit about the figures that have just been released? The headline, the quoted figure, is annual growth of 2.1%. But there's an array of other figures within it. Which of them gives us the truest picture of whether we're getting better off or worse off?
Yeah, so GDP is an interesting concept. It's essentially the value of all the things we've produced in our economy in 1 year. And there's a couple of ways at it. We can add it up by adding up all our wages and all the profits made by businesses. That's one way of working out what GDP is. Another way is to work out all the things we've consumed. We have to include exports in that because we did produce them, but we also have to subtract imports because we didn't produce those. So that is essentially what GDP is. The value of all the things we produced.
We've got three things, have we? We've got the value of all of our income, the value of everything we produce, and the value of everything we spent. And should the three of them be more or less the same after accounting for exports?
In theory, they should be more or less the same, yes. But it's very, very difficult in a country of the size of Australia and the size of the economy we have. It's very, very difficult to actually get those things to line up.
Before we go on to the difficulty of getting them to line up, which is what I want to ask you about, Terry, is it right to say that our standard of living has grown 2.1%? That's what the figure shows.
No, it's not right to say that. It's right to say that the value of all the stuff we produced has gone up by 2.1%. But to convert that into our standard of living, we need to make a few adjustments. So the first one is to adjust for the number of people that live here, which also grew. So in fact, GDP per person grew by 0.4%. So we had 2.1% more stuff produced, but we had also quite a lot of population growth, leaving us with 0.4% more per person.
That's immediately quite clear why we don't feel quite as good.
That's right. We have to share that 2.1% with more people. So,
and you said there's another adjustment.
Yes. And then there's another adjustment, which is that all the things we produce don't necessarily belong to us. So we have quite a lot of foreign ownership of businesses. And so the profits earned by those businesses belong to the owners of those businesses who may be overseas. Now, on the flip side, we own a lot of things overseas as well. And so we get to own that. But in the net, they own more of us than we own of them.
So when you make that adjustment, you get a different measure, which is, I think, called national income?
Gross national income, yes.
And that's more or less the same this time. It needn't be. Indeed, it differs quite a lot from time to time. But probably the best guess is that the standard of living, and this is adjusted for prices too, is increasing at 0.4% a year. Terry, how did you, in the Bureau of Statistics, marry these three different measures? Because I reckon if I tried to measure everything that was earned in Australia and everything that was produced in Australia and everything that was spent, with the best will in the world, the answers wouldn't be the same.
Yeah, and that's why we sort of use this, what I call a data confrontation methodology.
Data confrontation.
Confrontation. So we get our numbers from the expenditure side, so how much money is being spent, and we sort of look through it and go, okay, there's been a lot of spending on construction, you know, homes, bridges, train stations, etc. And then you sort of look at the production side, so which industries are doing stuff. So if the construction sector had a very low number, you start to go, well, hang on, if people are spending money on construction but the construction sector aren't building it, we might need to go back and sort of look at the numbers and try and balance them all together.
So you sit around a room saying, this piece of data I don't believe, this one looks more likely. Maybe if it was a survey, someone hasn't sent in their survey field, so maybe we should adjust this one to make it more like this one.
Yeah, so in, at the heart of that's this thing called a supply use table, which basically kind of tries to balance out the three expenditure, income, and production. So if there is a sort of one figure looking a bit weak, you go, well, what's happening here? Is it that a major construction firm forgot to submit their survey responses on time? Or is there some sort of timing issue? And it's interesting for me, sort of with the Black Friday sales, which fall on the last day of the month. You know, imagine that was the last day of the quarter. You'd have all these people saying, oh, I spent all these money on the stuff I've bought online. But the companies who are selling it, it's like, well, actually, the money doesn't hit my bank account until the following day, which is the next quarter. So it's those sorts of things you're trying to work out what's happening in this data confrontation.
I'm imagining a series of meetings continually throughout the 3 months where you're saying, look, this doesn't look right, this looks right, and using judgment.
Yeah, it's a judgment, especially because, you know, the National Accounts time series goes back to 1959. So you can sort of look back through history and go, oh, during this period, when this series went up as well. Whereas at the moment, we're looking around the table going, well, this one's gone up and this one's gone down. This is something does not quite compute. And then the supply use tables kind of help you sort of bring a bit of science to what's going on as well.
Can you understand, Janine, why someone might be losing confidence in the authority of the GDP at this stage?
I think the ABS does an incredible job in putting out the GDP. They put it out 4 times a year. The figures are pretty close. And the conversations that Terry's talking about are, in fact, the thing that gives me confidence, you know, that they're not just blindly looking at the forms and putting out the estimates. They really do think about it. Mm.
And also, the ABS is one of the few countries in the world which produce all three measures. Some countries just have the expenditure side. So we can actually go, oh, look, we've looked at this from three angles and we've got a very good comprehensive point of view. And I'll give a plug for a long-forgotten ABS publication, which is the annual national accounts. So the quarterly ones get all the attention, but then there's a set of full financial year numbers that come out where the ABS does an extra round of data confrontation. They get data dumps from the ATO to say, well, this is what the financials tell us about the previous year. And that kind of calibrates the quarterly. And that's what sort of caught people maybe a bit by surprise this quarter. They looked at the number and went, oh, 0.4, that's a bit low. But, oh, last quarter got revised upwards. So all this data confrontation, a few more survey forms were found, a bit more data analysis said, oh, actually, we've revised upwards or we've changed our previous estimate for the quarter, which sometimes people are like, what?
Well, I guess you have to revise history because new things arise. I remember the arrival of the iPhone, we all do, Netflix, online gambling. The ABS keeps finding out about new things. Or how do you find out about new things, Terry? Because they're not obvious. The rise in illicit tobacco, the rise in online gambling, it's not obvious.
Yeah, so, you know, the people at the ABS are constantly scanning the environment for, like, What is driving this particular series?
People sitting next to you on the bus? Oh, gee, I'm doing this with my phone. Oh, gee, that could be a service. Yes.
And it also kind of highlights that a lot of the statistical frameworks that the ABS use are international ones, and they're agreed on every 10 years. So sometimes those classifications are a little bit backwards looking. And I think we talked about this previously, Peter, about data centres. So if you look at the building activity survey, which feeds into the national accounts, data centres, which had a big number during the last quarter, it's collected with a bunch of other buildings. So I'm just going to read a few out. So it includes car washes, funeral homes, mail sorting centres, pet boarding facilities. So if you looked at that number and went, oh my God, it's jumped by X percent in the last quarter, is that because of pet boarding facilities? It's like, oh no, no, it's because of data centres coming through. So it's always about going, what is this number? What's the story about it? And I remember the guys who sort of, you know, looked after the farm income account, they would go and watch Landline, you know, every week to work out what's happening
really?
At the farm gate and sort of work out about the various seasons and when farmers do this and that, so they could come back and go, oh yeah, look, I understand these numbers. So it's not just looking at the numbers, there's lots of hard work to sort of get behind and understand what's happening.
Well, we saw an example of that in these figures. The Bureau of Statistics, firstly, it says it's going to investigate illicit tobacco, going to try and get numbers for it because it's now very big. It's for the first time included estimates of income, I suppose it's sort of income, from household solar. And they're now in the figures, and they've actually made a material difference to household consumption in the figures. How do they do that smoothly? By continuing to revise history?
Yeah, and this is kind of the challenge. And there's obviously been a divergence between people's consumption on cigarettes and what the ABS is reporting, because we've got this black market economy coming through there. So if the ABS went out there and sort of ran a survey and said, oh, Peter, how many cigarettes did you smoke last week? And you said, oh, I spent $50 on them. And they said, where'd you buy them from? And you said, oh, I bought them from a man out of the boot of his car. And they go, okay. So they sort of go, oh, it looks like right now it was probably a 50-50 split, let's say, between black market and commercial sales. So then they sort of add 50% onto the current number. And then they kind of go, well, all right, when the excise hit a certain point and consumption of cigarettes started to fall, there's probably, you know, a smaller percentage. And you sort of just try and draw the line between the two.
Another thing about GDP is that for the most part, it includes things that are valued in dollars and cents, because it's the things we produce and sell. And that is the majority of what we do these days. But GDP also includes the value of things produced in the home, marketable things produced in the home. And this includes rooftop solar. So this is produced in the home from solar panels on people's roofs. So that's now being included in GDP. It would have been fairly straightforward to include the purchase of the solar panel in GDP, because that's a commercial transaction. But now ABS is having to come up with creative ways of actually including the electricity produced in the GDP figure as well.
Janine, the figures which have been published this week are national. Is it possible to work out GSP, gross state product, for each state? And what do you find when you look across the nation?
Yes, so gross state product is certainly possible. The ABS produce that once a year. It varies a lot by state. So gross state product per capita, I'll talk in per capita terms just to step away from the fact that every state has a different population. So per capita, our richest state in GDP terms is about twice as rich as our poorest state in GDP terms.
Which one?
So Western Australia has GDP per capita of around $150,000, and Tasmania has GDP per capita of around $75,000.
So no wonder people feel as if the GDP isn't representing them. What happens when you do that other adjustment, the one you're talking about for income? Because a lot of that income from iron ore would not stay in Australia.
So this becomes quite tricky. So in the figures, the Western Australian figure is slightly lower when you adjust for income, but it's still pretty high. It's still $148,000 in income terms. So I'm not sure if that's actually accurate. I know there's a lot of high wage earning people in Western Australia, but the mining industry is a very high capital intensive industry. So that income from mining is really spread out all over the country to all states and, in fact, all over the world as well.
And indeed, in some parts of Western Australia, it would be concentrated and not in others. Terry, one of the things you used to publish in one of your earlier jobs was, I suppose you'd call it a GLP, a local domestic product for all sorts of different regions. And you've worked that out as best you can by working out where income's earned and where money's spent. What sort of patterns have you found?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that you can kind of see in areas where there's lots of mining activity tend to perform quite well because you have the mines, they're digging the ore out, they're generating the wages for the workers plus the profits Janine was kind of describing earlier. And then sort of historically, you've sort of seen that the CBDs are the big cities, so where there's lots of professional services, finance and insurance. And finance and insurance is another sector which is quite capital intensive. So stockbrokers, insurance brokers, for example, a lot of money goes across their desk and they take a clip percentage, but that kind of generates a lot of value add, a lot of sort of local GDP. So these CBDs performed really well. And then you've kind of got other parts of the cities, which are kind of your manufacturing bases, your Western Sydneys, your Western Melbournes, where they've kind of been in a bit of a structural sort of flatlining for a long time. And then you've got other parts, which are kind of your local shops, maybe a school. So they've got a different sort of population growth pattern. So it's not like there's one economy across the country. There's probably 40 or 50 or 100 different local economies all churning away with their own trends.
You do this too, Janine. You do this at the Centre for Policy Studies when you need to study the effect of a factory closure or a new enterprise on a town.
That's right. So when a factory or an enterprise closes in a town, we often focus on the job losses, which are clearly very important. But it's often the very same people who've just lost their job who've also just lost a lot of value from their dwelling. Because if you have a large employer in a small town that closes down, the value of the dwelling stock in that town also falls because job prospects are less and the town becomes a less attractive and lucrative place to live. So you have people who have not only lost their job and their livelihood, but have also, they become almost a little bit trapped because they lose value from their dwelling.
They can't move. They can't sell their house. It's suddenly worth less.
That's right. The exchange of that house for a house in a town where there are more jobs is an exchange where those people will make a loss. So it's really important to have this really clear idea of what's going on in the regions. And it is a tricky thing to measure gross regional product. And the thing is, as you move to smaller and smaller regions, the disconnect between what happens in a region and the incomes of the people in the region gets bigger and bigger.
Is that because they work in a different location perhaps to where they live?
That's right. It can be because they work in a different location to where they live. So as Terry said, a lot of activity takes place in city centres. So that makes the gross regional product of the city centre high. But if the people live in the suburbs, it's adding to the income of people in the suburbs.
And the working from home makes things even more complicated. So for a 5-day week, I might be in my home in Brunswick, and then I'm in Docklands working away, or I'm here in South Bank, or I'm in Darwin or Adelaide. So where my value add is sometimes hard to pin down.
And where you spend your money is hard to pin down as well. And I think one of the things we saw in COVID was that the CBD cafes and restaurants really took a strong hit, but the suburban cafes actually did very well out of it.
Well, pinning things down throughout Australia is one of the things we're keen to do here on The Economy Stupid, which is the title of this program on ABC Radio National, with me, Peter Martin, our guest this week, economic modeller and director of the Centre of Policy Studies at Victoria University, Janine Dixon, and director of Planning and Infrastructure Economics at KPMG Australia, Terry Rawnsley. Janine, we've discussed what the GDP is, how it's created, and all of the uncertainties involved. But what does it leave out? What's missing?
What's missing? So we started into that a moment ago when we talked about solar panels and the value of marketable things produced in the home. They're not missing. They're included. But there's a big chunk of activity that takes place in the home that is missing.
Now, as a man, as a male, I'm going to say, what kind of activity could you possibly be talking about?
What could it be, Peter? So all those service activities that we do in our own homes, so all our cooking and our cleaning and our taking care of our children, that is not included. So there's no value, there's no market value attributed to those activities at all.
Does it make any difference not including it?
It does, because one of the things we're often told is that GDP over the last 40 years or so per capita has doubled. So why don't we feel twice as rich as we used to? A lot of what was behind the doubling of GDP, a lot of it is technology and productivity improvements, but a lot of it is also female workforce participation. And so you have people working in the marketplace, and so they're earning money and they're adding to GDP, and they've now got less time of their own to spend at home, and they're probably more stressed out and pushing to really get all those home-based services completed as well, and that's not included. So there's probably to some extent the idea that home-based services, our own services that we produce for ourselves, are less good than they used to be because we're so rushed. So that loss is not included in GDP. And the other thing that's not included in GDP is the value of our leisure time. So when we're not working, we're either doing things for ourselves, home-based services, or we're doing leisure for ourselves. And those two things are not included.
So it's regarded as costless to be going out to work.
It is regarded as costless.
And it is not costless.
That's right, Peter.
There is a very big cost to us.
Yes.
Also, as women go into the workforce, some of them employ housekeepers.
That's right.
Some of them employ people to clean their house. So you're getting an increase in the measured amount of house cleaning without an increase in the amount of house cleaning.
That's exactly right, yes. And so there's a great saying from Paul Samuelson, which is that when a man marries his maid, the GDP goes down. So why is that? Because previously the maid was getting paid, and so that service was counted in GDP, and now the lucky maid has got to marry this man and gets to do this stuff for no pay.
Paul Samuelson, I should point out, is one of the most famous US economists who wrote the textbook that myself and possibly Terry and Janine were raised on. Is there something else missing from the GDP? Anything else, Terry? Anything big?
Well, I think its name probably gives a bit of a clue. It's called gross domestic product. So there's also sort of a next level down, which is sort of real net national disposable income. And what that does is takes accounts of basically depreciation, or as the National Account will call it, consumption of fixed capital. So saying every quarter we're producing stuff, but also we're drawing on our capital. Like I pull out my pen at the start of the quarter, I write with it, the ink goes through, and at the end of it, my capital's somewhat depleted.
Or we use up our iron ore.
Yes. Or we draw down on our natural resources.
Or we pollute the air.
Yes.
Or we pollute the rivers. And it's regarded as costless in a way.
Yeah, and this is why the national accounts starts to sort of add in things called satellite accounts. So these aren't sort of part of the core national accounts produced all the time, but there's a satellite account about unpaid work. There's a satellite account sort of relates to our quality of our waterways, because people are saying, oh, hang on, this production's great, but our rivers are drying up, or there's these pollution issues. So the satellite accounts try to sort of delve into those more detailed areas to go, okay, something else is going on.
So given what's missing, and this is, I suppose, the key question, can we trust the national accounts, the GDP, to give us a good idea of whether life is getting better or not? And I suppose this is taking into account that there are faults. Do you trust it, Janine?
I don't think it's a matter of trust. I think it's a matter of understanding actually what it is. So I trust that the figure has been produced accurately and that it does what it says it is on the tin. But I also know, and I think the awareness of this is really important, that it is not directly the same thing as our well-being, and it's really important to look at other measures of well-being. And we can start from the net national disposable income per capita, which at least gives us a measure of our material well-being. But then I think beyond that, there are countries that do surveys of well-being and produce well-being measures, and I think that's really, really important as well.
Do you think it tells us whether we're getting better off, Terry? I must say I do. I'm a huge fan. If you look at different countries at different times, you can even tell whether people are smiling or not by whether the economy is going up or down.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to Janine's point, you know, happiness is a little bit detached from the vagaries of the national accounts. The other thing as well that, you know, we're talking about GDP, but that really is the tip of the iceberg when it comes to it. Because you can look through the expenditure side and go, okay, what's driven this increase in GDP? Is it government defence spending, which probably makes no one feel that much better? Or is it household consumption going up? You go, oh, well, that's good. People are spending more. But then you go, oh, that household consumption is being driven by higher electricity bills and higher insurance bills, which isn't, you know, very fun. But if it's being driven by consumption on cafes, restaurants, bars, you know, recreational goods, you go, oh, well, that's going up and people are obviously having a good time. So you just can delve into all the various components kind of go, all right, this number is what it is, but what's it telling me about how the economy is performing out there and how might that relate to people's happiness?
Another point about GDP is that it's an aggregated measure, so it doesn't tell us anything about the distribution of incomes. So if Gina Reinhart makes an extra $1 billion, GDP goes up by $1 billion. But if everybody makes an extra little bit and GDP goes up by $1 billion, it looks the same.
But it's very different for everyone other than one person.
It's very different, yes.
Janine, Terry, thank you. Before we go, as is traditional on this program, anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Terry?
I think there was, you know, something for everybody in the quarterly accounts released this week. We sort of saw finally a tick up in business investment, which people have been lamenting for a long time. So business investment helps productivity in the long term. The productivity number was better than it's been. Households look to be spending a bit more. Government spending, which has sort of taken the load over the last couple of years, seems to have hit a peak and starting to slow in terms of growth. So I think there was a whole range of positives around there's this transition from public sector spending to the private sector. And I think the trend is looking positive, but I think we just want to see more business investment, improvements in productivity that'll help that sort of supply chains and general overall inflation. So I think every quarter we'll kind of understand how that transition's going, and hopefully when you invite us back in 12 months' time, Peter, we can provide a much more positive outlook for the Australian economy and the distribution for households' income in there as well.
What are you looking out for, Janine, in the days and weeks ahead?
Yeah, so in the days and weeks ahead, the Productivity Commission is going to release its final reports on its five pillars inquiries, which are really interesting. They cover really everything that you'd want in an economy. I think dynamism and resilience, the skilled and adaptable workforce, digital technology, care, and the energy transition. So I think
these are the ones associated with commission before, but associated with that productivity summit they had in Parliament House 100 or so days ago.
Indeed. So around the time of the summit, they released their interim reports, but the final reports will be coming out quite soon, and I think they'll contain some really interesting information.
Janine Dixon, Director of the Centre of Policy Studies at Victoria University, and Terry Rawnsley, Director of Planning and Infrastructure Economics at KPMG Australia. Thank you both so much for giving us an insight into what's certainly the most important economic figure to come out every quarter. Thank you both.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or listen live on ABC Radio National Thursdays. If you've any thoughts or questions or comments, no economic question is stupid, you can email us. Laura has done that via the economy.stupid@abc.net.au. She writes about our superannuation episode in which we outlined how much super retirees have left over when they die. She suggests it's unfair and inefficient given all the subsidies we give to super, and maybe we should have a death duty or an inheritance tax. A fair point, given that in the US, the UK, Japan and much of the rest of Europe, they do. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.